Maya Sherman is an AI policy researcher, technology diplomat, and innovation attaché at the Israeli Embassy in India. With a background from the Oxford Internet Institute, her work sits at the intersection of AI governance, digital ethics, and global policy. She also leads AI literacy initiatives with the Global Partnership on AI at the OECD, helping shape responsible AI adoption across emerging economies.
Ladies and gentlemen, Maya Sherman. Welcome, Maya, to the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you so much, and it's wonderful to be here in such a wonderful podcast. Thank you.
Just want to go a little back to your career. You started your career, as I mentioned, monitoring the darknet, tracking cybercrime, hate speech, violent extremism. That is a world away from writing AI ethics papers at Oxford and representing Israel at the OECD. What happened in between, and do you think that background in the digital underground actually makes you a better AI governance practitioner than someone who came straight from law or public policy?
I think that in the end, there is no right or wrong when it comes to careers and generally the decision to move, I guess, from the bad guys, which usually are the cybersecurity folks, into data ethics, which is a whole different practice. For me, I feel that it's more a causational relation, in the sense that I've learned and saw the perhaps darker side of technologies, of what happens when you have malign institutes and actors trying to harm the fact that data is accessible and users are not fully aware of what can happen. So I think that for me, it gave me such a wonderful window of, first of all, the problematic aspects of what technology can do. In the same time, this window enabled me to understand that I want to do good things with technologies. I believe that technology should and can serve society. But in the same time, you know, if you're asking me on today, I will tell you that I believe that my background in cybersecurity and afterwards moving into data ethics enables me today to be a practitioner that knows also how to create safer data platforms that are also ethical, which I think is kind of like the next stage. So if in the past I thought that, again, data ethics is limited in scope and it's usually theoretical, speaking only of society, today we do understand that cybersecurity and AI go together. We want more data points all over. We need to make them safer. So I think that for me, it's an interesting evolution that happened and helped me shape my path in the space.
In your LinkedIn profile, it says that your interest in surrealism as a child led you to eventually to AI ethics. That is not a connection most people would make, or in some cases, they would not know what surrealism is. Can you unpack that for our audience? What is the link between surrealism and responsible AI, Maya?
Thank you for this. So I started in arts, actually, way before cybersecurity and technology. So I've always been in humanities. And I think that technology is an artistic tool that helps us shape reality in a different way. Surrealism is a wonderful artistic genre. That it's all about the exception and the paradoxes. What you usually see in surrealism is taking abstract figures and realistic figures and trying to connect them in illogical manners to be able to create a new narrative or a new discipline. One of the, I guess, the biggest artists of our times is known as Salvador Dali or René Magritte. And that's, you know, for me, and, you know, there are different ways to explain surrealism, but for me, it's the arts of the impossible and the exception. Responsible AI, for me, is a paradox. It's something that's not always making sense, because when you're thinking on AI and its core and why it was supposed to serve initially, you would say it's a pretty much, a capitalistic way to, again, to mimic human reactions, to be able to increase scope, to increase efficiency. And I guess that for me, as someone who has been exploring ethics, I've always been drawn to explore the gray areas, meaning the areas where impossible is becoming a reality. So for me, it's also connected to the study of quantum, perhaps also, again, to a lot of the work that's being done, you know, on AI in the global south, because in many ways, AI exacerbates digital divide, is actually causing a lot of harm to the global south, but still we're using it so substantively. So I think that these paradoxes, it can be in art, it can be in tech, but they have a lot of in common. The way I perceive it.
You said it's causing a lot of harm to the global south AI. Can you just elaborate? What kind of harms do you think AI is causing?
When I'm speaking about the harms, I'm speaking especially about the damage to informal sector, the damage to certain professions that do not really have a certain advantage in an automated era. I'm speaking about deepfakes and the threat of users not being aware of how their data is being spread and used by third-party entities. And I think that more than anything, when we're speaking about the Global South, when we have this AI spread all over, we are aware that we are exacerbating the digital divide. Now, in the current age where we're in, we do have a lot of professions, populations that do not have the accessibility to technology. So the fact that we're relying so much on AI is also pushing them away. A lot of my work, I would say, in India and in other places has been to see how we can skill the informal sector and farmers and a lot of other professions that do not really have a reality in the AI-generated era. Now, why is this a threat? Because I don't think that any of us has this kind of guarantee that AI is the best technology for all. It's true for any technologies. Each technology has a certain lobby, a certain, political power behind. So AI is, of course, very beneficial for certain parts of the population, but not for all. And Global South currently, in the way that it is, also has a lot of gaps, different population. Not everyone is necessarily technologically driven, neither it's supposed to be. But because we are so dependent on AI, it's almost like coming and saying, everyone who is not digital driven or studied computer science in the past has no place in the new era. And there is intersectionality. So, of course, in the Global South, it's been seen more than in other places.
As you also mentioned, the majority of the people, especially in the Global South, who are going to be most affected by AI decisions live in informal economies, maybe not on the grid in many cases. How do you design governance mechanisms that give a genuine voice to those communities that neither have a seat at the table nor the legal and institutional infrastructure to exercise their rights in a formal AI regulatory process?
So I think this is a question that the AI community is still exploring. We are testing different things, different models, because it's complex. I would say that I feel that India is a wonderful example of a country that is trying to revolutionize this space. Think of the Impact Summit alone. This was the most diverse gathering we've seen up until now of all the previous AI summits. Because again, the first one that did not have any cost for entry, that the entire process for sessions and stakeholders was fully democratized. And this is one thing. What India has been doing quite brightly, I would say, is everything connected to designing tech literacy initiatives as part of policy schemes, as part of the government work. Then all of a sudden, we do have the very strong presence of big tech companies in India. In the same time, we're also seeing the support of the different state governments when it comes to skilling initiatives across the country. A wonderful example is what the government of Uttar Pradesh is doing. The government of Uttar Pradesh, in collaboration with Intel and a lot of other big tech companies, they are designing tech literacy initiatives for the use of the state. Now, UP is not the only state that is doing it. In the end, India, in the scale of it, you are seeing different states that are operating in such manners. Now, that's the way, in my belief, through tech literacy initiatives and through the involvement of educational institutions, to be able to bridge this gap. Because in the end, we want, first of all, to make sure that everyone has access to AI, understand what it is, and also has the autonomy to choose and say, I want to do X, Y, and Z with AI. Now, it can be going to a tech company. It can also be a farmer coming and saying, I know what AI is, but I choose my own profession. I'm not necessarily going into the tech-driven arena. So I think that the balance is this agency that the policies can give to users. Now, I wish other countries would have followed, the initiatives related to tech literacy in the same scope that India, and again, I think other countries are doing currently, but it's not so common because it requires a lot of investments, and usually the big tech companies are the one getting most of the attention.
But talking about India, India also has made a deliberate choice not to pass any prescriptive AI legislation and basically issued the digital personal protection rules and a set of principles based on advisory frameworks. You participated in a lot of the stakeholder roundtables in those rules. From a global perspective, according to you, does India's light touch approach to AI regulation Is that a strategic advantage, or you think of it as a governance gap?
I think that India's approach is smart, because in many ways I feel that the country is trying a lot of different governance mechanisms based on what others are doing. And let me explain. We are seeing different regulations, different initiatives of governance, other than interministerial committees of METI. We are seeing deepfake regulations, advisories that are coming all the time. But I think that the beauty about what India is doing is, first of all, the attention to the industry. So we've saw this in the past. We had stricter disclaimers and requirements from AI companies, again, to declare that their content is AI-driven. It was, again, in the previous with the previous METI minister, the moment that the backlash from the industry came, there was a shift. Meaning, I do feel that there are some very interesting initiatives for legislation in the country. We had quite a recent one actually connected again, of course, DPDP, but more interestingly about deepfakes that came out quite recently, 3 days after before the summit, which of course made all of us work a bit harder. I feel that this attention to what the public is saying, to what how the industry is reacting, is what I think giving the Indian ecosystem a bit of breath to work, to think more critically on how this regulation is supposed to work. Honestly speaking, we are not seeing countries coming with very strict AI regulation, except for Europe. And honestly speaking, Europe is also trying to see how they can shift a bit more into responsible AI investments. So if the recent years we've seen a much, I would say, stronger approach toward the AI legislation and regulation and online safety, we are seeing that currently countries are trying to see how to promote industry, how to make sure that startups and companies are better suited to AI. So this is an era, I feel, of stronger AI investment, trying to increase the capacity of the industry. In the same time, there are certain safeguards. And safeguards will always be when it comes to deepfake threats, online safety, and generally whenever we're seeing electoral processes happening in countries, so all this discussion happen again. So I think that Indian approach is very smart. The only perhaps, I cannot say critique, but perhaps the only caveat would be that sometimes, again, there are so many different approaches and there is this, again, almost, again, waiting for the public's reaction that perhaps make India wait before seeing the next legislation. There was an interesting, again, initiative or trying to do the AI regulation. It was a committee that lasted over a year. And then I think a few months ago, METI said, again, we are not promoting currently regulation. We are trying to let the industry grow. And this is a balance. I don't think that any country managed to find the right solution, and that's a beauty. I think each country needs to do whatever works best for them. Israel, an example of a country that would not do a regulation for AI because we prefer and prioritize our industry. We need the industry to grow. So we released this agile advisories by Ministry of Justice, and especially in the summit, we're having a lot of discussion about this, but there is no right or wrong. I do think that the approach of India has been very smart in the AI ecosystem about this.
You also mentioned that AI landscape is becoming block-shaped. I mean, you see what the U.S. is doing. We don't have regulation per se. We have state-level initiatives across, and it's pro-innovation. Europe is basically a rules-based regulation, and India has just joined the U.S.-led PAC Silica initiative along with Israel, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and the UAE. What does this mean, Maya, for countries that are not in that bloc, the African Union, Southeast Asian nations, South America? How do you see the world kind of coming together in terms of AI regulation and AI policies? You have US or US-led initiative, you have EU, then China has its own algorithmic-driven mechanism. What is your perspective on this?
I think that, first of all, we're seeing a lot of different coalitions and blocs in the last few years, not just technological ones. Think of BRICS. India is about to host BRICS as well. We have G20. Again, now PAC Silica is a very interesting initiative. And when we're thinking of it, if up until now we saw this arms race of countries in the AI space, meaning each country was trying to make sure that then they have the best sovereign models, strongest AI strategy, not necessarily aligned with other countries. The thing is, we are seeing different tech blocks and also, again, non-tech blocks. We're seeing blocks of nations. I think that we're at this point seeing that countries are trying to collaborate more and to see how they can create more scalable infrastructures together based on shared values. The beauty is that, you know, Pax Silica is the one tech block with certain countries. First of all, more countries might be added. The thing is, there are additional blocks. Whatever happens with BRICS will also be very interesting. G20 will be in the US. Switzerland will host the next AI summit. I think that we are seeing different blocks which are changing and are slightly dynamic. I would say that, of course, we are seeing certain actors that are not part of this block. So China is a fascinating actor in the AI space for many reasons. But of course, and it's an actor that is also driving the community to act. So after DeepSeek, nations started to react and come in saying, we want to see indigenous models. 3 days after the declaration of DeepSeek, in Orissa, India declared that they are about to build the foundational models. And I think that's the smart part. First of all, to understand that these blocks are not set in stone. We have blocks across disciplines. And this is also the role of India. You know, I think a lot of the foreign policy of India has been about creating different coalition, different blocks based on shared values. That's why I think a lot of the partners of India not necessarily get along, but and it changes between countries. But I think that we will see more blocks, tech-driven, not tech-driven, and the position of countries might change. Up until now, we saw the EU as one strong block on regulation. It's no longer the case. Pax Silica is a wonderful counter to this. The way that the Middle East is becoming more relevant for this discussion, it will be interesting to see what BRICS might create. Again, interesting to see China, Russia, India. I think that's the kind of discussion that will force countries to collaborate with different actors according to different scenarios. But to me, it feels slightly agile because we are seeing countries trying to gather together around these topics. Why is this happening? I feel that it has a lot because we're seeing a lot of crises in the world, way from COVID to wars to misinformation and deepfake. And I think that once we see so many conflicts, countries need to connect better to be able to solve some wicked problems because one country alone cannot solve it. And COVID-19 was a great example to this.
And you said the AI summit was a big mela. So explain to our visitors what you meant and how did it come up? What was your perspective of the AI summit? And we'll talk a little bit more about that.
So Mela is, in my perspective, again, it's a big, big gathering of people coming together. Specifically in India, there are different Melas. We have the Kumbh Mela, again, according to different locations in the country. Usually they are associated with some religious dates. And especially you would see that the point of a lot of this Mela is, again, to bring people together to celebrate, again, either religious dates or other things as well. And I was saying it especially because I feel that the India AI Summit was probably one of the sole instances where we saw the entire AI community from Global North and Global South coming together to discuss and celebrate AI, celebrate the phase that AI has reached. And this democratization of AI is, I feel, first of all, it's at the core, perhaps, of the Melas in which all people can come. Of course, we had the previous Mela in Uttar Pradesh, one of the biggest gatherings. It was a year ago, where everyone could come to, again, to be able to bathe in the Ganga. And it had, again, a very strong spiritual meaning. Now, specifically in the AI summit, of course, it's not necessarily religious, but the entire point is to bring everyone, whoever wants and has the interest, to learn more about AI, to bring them all in the same space and discuss. So for me, it was a fascinating AI Mela. Again, chaotic, disorganized in cases, but fully democratized. You know, in the summit, we saw students and we saw Sam Altman entering the same halls. And that's the beauty. Now, it's not always feasible. And honestly speaking, I don't think that the next editions will be as diverse because that's part of the beauty in India. India is all about democratization of data and making access for all. But yeah, I think that all of us were saying that, again, there were so many people around and across all stages, and everyone who just wanted to know what AI is had a place to see one of the, you know, core restrictions of any session that we organize in the summit by Meiti was that every session is accessible for all. Meaning if someone registered to the summit, was accepted, he can attend any possible session that was online. And that's the beauty. This was, of course, except for the inauguration, which has, of course, a lot of other security restrictions. But this is something that I feel, first of all, is not so common in the AI space and generally in the tech space. It's usually very excluding. And yeah, I mean, I think in many ways it was a wonderful, gigantic gathering of more than 300,000 people all across the world coming and trying to see what AI is causing us as a society, as practitioners, as government to government.
But you also said that at the summit that AI is not yet well suited for childhood, that if we advocate for machines, we promote efficiency, but if we advocate for childhood, we promote potential. Can you explain that for our audience, what you mean by that, Maya?
Sure. One of the most interesting topics that came out of the summit was everything connected to online safety and how we're able to protect kids. Now, more grown-up individuals, we get exposed to AI, we understand how screens work. The thing is, younger generation do not still have the tools sometimes, or perhaps the safeguards to be able to defend themselves from any potential threats. Think that sometimes even the grown-ups might suffer, but of course, when it comes to the younger generation, we have a problem. And specifically when we're speaking about AI spread, we are aware of the risks to education, the potential, threat to the human ability to think. Now, if we up until now were able to think in a certain way, to develop, to create our own creative skills, in the AI era, we're in a different place. Now, we have this important skill, which is to make sure that kids understand tech, but they are also able to communicate, to create friendships, to go outside, to think critically of the world. So in my perspective, and this is something that was wonderfully created by great practitioners in the summit, we know that AI is important. We are seeing it all over. We have so many screens around. But it doesn't necessarily mean that younger generation will find a job. It doesn't mean that they really have the right skills to be able to think critically of situations. A lot of the skills that we used to develop in the offline world are taken. So you would say that a lot of actually initiatives that, you know, some of them are, again, are done by some interesting design companies. Whenever they're trying to design products for kids, they're also trying to create some offline spaces without AI so that they'll be able to develop their own personal thinking. It might change in the future. We might be able to create interfaces that are hybrid and are still better suited also for kids in a way that will not harm their critical thinking or their ability to create friendships outside of the digital space. But we are not there yet. And I think it's a lot because we have this AI hype. We want it to be everywhere. So we are not paying enough attention to the critical skills that we know are important in the educational process. This is, I feel, a balance that we might need to adhere in the next few years. It was heavily repeated in the summit, and I think it was a very interesting insight and observation that came up from people, understanding that, yes, we are running with AI, but younger generation might pay a big price for it.
So in your view, should the younger generation, should we have age limits? Like you look at Australia has basically barred social media for people, I think, below 18. Do you think there should be an age limit in terms of use of AI?
So in Israel, we had different discussions about it. You know, what should we do in classroom when it comes to using smartphones, or generally social media platforms? I think that at this point, prohibition alone is a bit delusional in the sense that it's all over. And also we cannot really promote all these spaces for only adults and come to say to kids, oh, you're outside of it, but you'll see other people using it. I think that we need to think of smarter ways of enabling a more moderated usage for younger generation. I do not believe in full prohibition because I think it just caused the other effect. And in the end, we also want to make sure that kids are tech driven and are able to use technologies critically. China is also taking a similar approach, again, to when it comes to younger generation and in assessment, that again, AI usage is not allowed. I think that we need to see better how we are creating the right moderation of usage to make sure that we are preventing the harms. But I think at full prohibition, I'm not sure it will lead to the right results, simply because we want paradoxical things. We also want this younger generation to be good in tech. So we don't really want to keep them awake. So this age prohibitions, I think they might lead to some ambiguous results, but it will be very interesting to see what the Australian legislation might lead into.
Innovation attaché is something new. Most embassies generally deal with political stuff or trade stuff, etc. Tell our listeners, what is an innovation attaché, and how do you deal with the bureaucracy and trying to push things along when AI is moving at such a fast startup speed? So that's something our audience wanted to know from you.
It's a unique position. We don't have it in all embassies. We have it, I guess, in embassies where we see the potential of tech relations. There are different attachés. An attaché is, I would say, in a simplistic manner, is a subject matter expert for a certain domain in the embassy. It is responsible for advancing the specific engagements, ecosystem engagements around this vertical. So specifically for me, I'm leading the ecosystem engagement around bilateral innovation relations between Israel and India. It comes to designing startup programs, bilateral government discussions around tech policy, policy analysis across the countries, initiatives of strategic dialogue around tech. So it's quite wide in its scope. And I would say that my KPI is one, which is to make sure that both ecosystems are able to interact, to know each other's strengths, arrange delegations whenever possible of both countries, and just to make sure that we're able to maximize the common interest of tech practitioners of both nations, in the same time to see how they can complement. And both India and Israel are different in terms of how their tech ecosystem is built. So a lot of my work is to see how they can complement, in what ways we can bring Israeli expertise into India, and in the same time, to see what exactly are the strong assets that we would like to bring from India to Israel. And the synergy is quite dual. For us, it's we understand the advantages of both ecosystems, and we're trying to maximize it, whether, again, through ecosystem engagement and hackathons and university collaborations. And the list goes on and on. And we live in a times that AI is all over. That's why there is a very strong focus also on innovation and AI relations between the countries. This is something that might increase with time. But specifically, I can say that now we're also shifting into AI and agriculture. So agriculture is traditional domain of collaboration. Now with AI and emerging technologies, we are deepening much more Israeli technologies and again, agriculture practices in India and vice versa. So the thing is, we are now trying to also digitize and innovate some of the traditional collaborations and traditional verticals that we used to have between the countries.
No, it's fantastic. And you did some work in the agriculture sector with those farmers in Nasik in multiple Indian languages. Again, these are people who are in an informal sector, and they're using, what are they using AI for? Tell our listeners just briefly, when you were working with these farmers, how is it being used, and whether it's a crop disease detection app, and are there any governance protections that they need? Tell our listeners a little bit about that, Maya.
This was an initiative by GPI OECD, meaning a multilateral organization, as part of the Future of War Committee. The entire point was to see how we are scaling up the informal sector, specifically farmers. Farmers are an important part of Indian economy. And the thing is, was first of all, to show them what they can do with AI, how it's relevant for them, rather than telling them, oh, you have to use AI now, do as you please. Because especially for certain professions, we want to make sure that we're able to bring the relevant use cases. So one of the most common ones, first of all, is the ability to, again, use chatbot to get information on potential services. Real-time translation, I think this is probably one of the biggest use cases of AI in agriculture. We're seeing this with different chatbots designed by, again, Bhashini and Digital India and a lot of other government entities, specifically thinking on the Indian landscape. We have 22 official languages, more than 900 unofficial ones. Language diversity is key, especially in the informal sector, because agriculture is all across the country is diverse. Crops monitoring, of course, weather prediction, climate, climate hazards monitoring and prevention. The entire point that we were trying to show the farmers, first of all, what are the existing use cases? That's the one that I just mentioned, to show them a bit of a global perspective. The thing is, actually, because there are plenty of Indian languages, we did it in Nasik, so we did the course in Marathi and Hindi, and again, also English is something that we worked on. There are additional regions and additional pilots that, again, are relevant and we are planning to work on in collaboration with Bhashini as well. The entire point was first of all to show them a case study approach to AI in agriculture, trying to showing them through this video-based course what are the relevant options for them, not under an assumption that this is for sure a must thing to do, but other to expose them to something that can be relevant for them in the future. Now, we did this in collaboration with open universities in India, five open universities in India, so they'll also be able to get a certificate, a professional certificate in the end. The point is also to give them something that will be able to be relevant for them on the professional side. For instance, if a farmer wants to use this certificate to be able to get into other jobs, to have certain functions. So we wanted to have this kind of a life learning component into it. Interesting intervention. I would say it was a very good one in terms of the scope and the adoption. But for instance, one of the things that we hope to do in the future is to see if we can do this also with female farmers. So intersectionality is also an issue. We are aware that certain interventions in terms of the deadline will be able to be executed with certain parts of the population. Even, Nasik. The reason why we chose Nasik is because digital literacy is higher. So we know that they'll be able to use smartphones in a certain way. This was done in WhatsApp and Telegram. The question comes again, what about regions where digital connectivity is not the highest and digital adoption is not so high? But, that's the beauty about the domain that, we're, again, taking paradoxes and surreal instances to see how we can use AI smartly and more accessibly for anyone who wants to be part of it, even if they were not born to the right circumstance or to the right setting for them to be able to learn about it.
No, fantastic. Maya, you also participated in the European policy seminars in Brussels, Estoril and Prague, representing Oxford in conversations about the European digital governance and crisis AI. And now you operate regularly in the India OECD governance space. Where do you see the big differences in Europe or Southeast Asian governance cultures when they approach the question of AI accountability, and which do you think is more durable over the long term?
For me, as someone who is not European nor Indian, but I guess lived in both places, I feel that it's about the perception of ethics. And this is something that I actually heard when I firstly came to India. And I remember this being said in Carnegie, in GTS, in one of the biggest conferences. And it was especially in an interaction between the British delegation coming to the summit and some of the DPI pioneers of India. And they were telling, all of a sudden, the British delegation was speaking about the need of doing, again, creating more ethical safeguards and making sure that everything is accountable and not using AI anywhere because of privacy. And then, from the other side of the stage, what was said to the British delegation is that, in the end, ethics can also be a certain part of a privileged discussion because India has a lot of problems to solve. And if we wait for the ethics, the problems will remain. And there are a lot of problems and issues for Indian population to deal with. So they're very apologetic that they cannot be so accountable or transparent, but problems need to be solved. Now, there is no true or wrong here. I think that in the end, today, we do understand that ethics is not something that can be a privilege. Ethics is also relative, meaning the way that I'm perceiving ethics will be different the way that you might perceive ethics. And that's the beauty because, again, we're different humans, different contexts, so we are supposed to perceive what's right or wrong differently. And it's contextual in many ways. But when you're thinking of Europe and India, there are different interests, there are different power relations. Europe is prioritizing regulation and safeguards. a lot because that's been, again, the strengths of Europe, not necessarily the strongest industry player investment, but very strong academician, theoretical foundation, and a lot of knowledge and evidence on how you're tackling child safety because you have a lot of data that you collected. India, for instance, is a different actor. It's an actor that, first of all, faces data collection issues in certain parts. Digital divide is key. A lot of different problems, but probably the leader of the Global South when it comes to the tech space, and also a fantastic bridge between Global North and Global South, and an actor that is also bringing diversity by design. The DPI revolution, UPI as a concept, these are terms that are new to the tech ecosystem. And this is what India is bringing to the table. And I think that when you're seeing both, you know, approaches, each country took an approach that is suited to its own national interest. So Europe, of course, wants to promote regulation and the safeguards because, again, better suited to their own workforce. India is coming to solve a lot of the problems of a very diverse population and also to be able to connect to the different blocks that the country is forming. What's better? I think that the Indian approach is more interesting to me because I feel that it's India tried to do more initiatives and tested different approaches to how AI governance can be. So we've seen regulations in India, we've seen co-governance, we've seen bottom-up approaches, we've seen DPI, we've seen user in the center, government in the center. Europe, I think, was taking a more perhaps coherent approach, but was not testing a lot of other things. So again, but the question is who will be better suited? I do think that India currently is in a more interesting position also in terms of the block that it's currently in. But let's see. I mean, it's also the question, you know, the next crisis that we'll see in the AI space, like Cambridge Analytica, might bring again the discussions on stricter regulation. And then Europe will get into power. And when Quantum comes, I think all the discussions might shift again. So yeah, I think it's very interesting approaches. They're different. And India was taking part of the European approaches in some of the legislation as well.
Finally, Maya, if you had 30 minutes with the UN Secretary General, who was there at the summit, and CEOs of the five largest AI companies in the world in the same room, who were basically almost all there, and they had to listen and they had to act, what would you ask them to do? Just one thing that would move the global responsible AI needle the most right now.
We should put a much stronger emphasis on linguistic diversity in the models. And while certain countries can afford foundational models, not all countries can. And this is something I think should be a right of countries. Strong nations like China, India, US can have the foundational models, especially again for the linguistic diversity, but we need to go above this. I feel that each country today should have its own sovereign models. We need to put much more focus on languages adaptability in these models. And again, also Israel, again, for us, the official languages are Hebrew and Arabic. They're not as strong in the models, clearly. In India, of course, and then the fact that we've been focusing so much on Anglo-Saxon languages, this does not reflect the AI community today. Today, the AI community is finally more diverse. There are more voices, and it should be reflected in the data.
Awesome. Linguistic diversity and also sovereign models, I think. That's the message to the Secretary General and the CEOs of the five biggest AI companies. A lot of them do watch the show, so hopefully they'll get the message from Maya. So Maya, AI regulation, is it a necessary guardian or an innovation handbrake?
Innovation handbrake.
The EU AI Act, is it a gold standard or a Brussels overreach?
Brussels overreach.
Okay. India's data protection rules, is it a framework or a fig leaf?
Framework.
Deepfakes, is it the biggest near-term AI threat or is it overhyped?
Overhyped.
General purpose AI, should we regulate it or should we trust the developers to self-govern?
We should regulate it at this point.
Okay. But the term ethical AI, is it a meaningful standard or is it corporate PR?
Meaningful standard.
Okay. Finally, AI in 10 years from now, will it be more democratized or will it be more centralized?
Democratized. Hope so, at least.
Maya, this has been one of those conversations that really genuinely expands the frame. And what strikes me most about your work is that you hold two things simultaneously that most people treat as contradictions, you know, a profound technical and policy rigor and a deep humanity. You're thinking about AI governance for 20,000 farmers in Nasik and for the highest level diplomatic table at the OECD at the same time. That is where the world of AI definitely needs more of it. And to our listeners, whether you're a policymaker in Brussels, an entrepreneur in Bangalore or Silicon Valley, or an AI researcher in Nairobi, or a civil society advocate in Buenos Aires, I hope this conversation has given you not just new ideas, but a renewed sense that the global AI governance challenge is tractable. Not easy, not fast, but tractable when the right people like Maya are in the room. And thank you, Maya Sherman. It has been a genuine honor. And thank you to our listeners for being part of this conversation. If this episode moved you, share it with one person in your network who needs to hear it. This is how the community grows. Maya, thank you so much. Really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Sanjay. Wonderful to be here.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI podcast with Sanjay Puri. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to leave a comment. We'd love to hear what you thought. Share it with someone curious about the future of AI and join us next time for more stories and insights from the leaders shaping what's ahead. Right here on the Regulating AI podcast.